All right, starting off here with Europe and Eurasia, we are looking at the Russo-Ukrainian War. Now, in the aftermath of what I will call Ukraine's failed counteroffensive over the summer, there's been a lot of talk over things like Ukraine's force posture, the average age of servicemen in the military, and issues they're having with mobilization. For example, in November, using data from the European Union, the BBC reported that 650,000 military-age Ukrainian males have fled the country for Europe since the invasion began in February of 2022. This doesn't take into account the number of men that have fled to other countries as well, such as the U.S. or Canada. Now, if you don't already know, just before the invasion happened, I mean, literally days before it happened, Ukraine placed a ban on men aged 18 to 60 leaving the country without special permission for the purposes of mobilizing them into the security forces. Now, on December 1st, President Volodymyr Zelensky acknowledged that changes must be made to the way that his country has been mobilizing citizens for service. He said that the changes are necessary, especially as Ukraine switches to the defense after, again, what I will call was a severely lacking counteroffensive over the summer. Moving on to France, on December 2nd, today, a French man of Iranian origin started randomly stabbing tourists near the Eiffel Tower while yelling Allahu Akbar. One person, a dual national of Germany and the Philippines, is dead and two others are injured. The man, Armand R., is already known by authorities for ties to jihadism. Armand has expressed his anger towards the death of Muslims in Afghanistan and Palestine. He also called France an accomplice to Israel and pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. He was tased and arrested at the scene. If any updates come of that, I'll be sure to let you guys know. Moving on to the Indo-Pacific region, looking at Japan, on November 29th, a U.S. Air Force CV-22 Bravo Osprey assigned to the 21st Special Operations Squadron with eight airmen on board crashed off the coast of Japan's Kagoshima Prefecture while on a routine training mission. One airman was found and was later declared dead. He has been identified as Staff Sergeant Jacob Gallier, 24, of Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Staff Sergeant Gallier was a direct support operator assigned to the 43rd Intelligence Squadron, Detachment 1 of the 363rd Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance Wing. He leaves behind his wife and two sons. Seven airmen remain missing in the U.S., and Japanese Coast Guards and navies are searching for them right now. We'll update you guys with that as well. Looking at Central Asia and the Middle East, of course, the Israel-Hamas war got reported casualties. Again, these are reported casualties. These are not confirmed. You also got to pay attention to where the source is coming from. So for Gaza, for example, this is coming from the Gaza Health Ministry, which is run by Hamas because they're the governing authority in the Gaza Strip. You have 15,207 killed, 40,652 injured. Looking at Israel, you have 1,332 killed. That does include the casualties that Israel has taken inside Gaza with their military operation. You also have 7,271 injured. Now, Israel's casualties inside Gaza, you have 70 killed in action, 260 wounded. Again, I can't really find a good up-to-date number for the wounded. That number is about a month old, and many more have been wounded since then. Looking at the West Bank, you have 245 killed, 2,469 injured. Lebanon, you have 107 killed. That includes at least 80 members of Hezbollah. Looking at Syria, you have 30 killed. In Egypt, you have 9 injured. That gives us a total of 16,921 killed, 50,401 people injured. The IDF has announced the death of Colonel Asaf Hamami, commander of the Gaza Division's Southern Brigade. Hamami was killed on October 7th, and his body is currently being held in Gaza by Hamas. He is the most senior officer that was abducted by Hamas in the October attack. He is also the fourth colonel that has been killed so far in the war. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, the number of journalists and media workers that have been killed in this war is 61. The vast majority, 54, were Palestinians that have been killed inside Gaza. You also have 4 Israelis and 3 Lebanese journalists that have been killed as well. Again, this is all since October 7th. On November 29th, there was a shooting attack at the entrance to Jerusalem. 2 Palestinian men affiliated with Hamas killed 3 people and injured 5 others at a bus stop in the area. They were killed by two off-duty soldiers and an armed civilian as well. Additionally, that armed civilian, Yuval Daron Castleman, was killed by security forces that mistook him for one of the attackers. An investigation has been launched into his death. The three other victims are Olivia Dickman, Elimelech Wasserman, and Hannah Ifargan. Hamas has claimed responsibility for this attack. The two attackers were brothers, Murad Namer, 38, and Ibrahim Namer, 30. They were Hamas members from the Sir Barer neighborhood of East Jerusalem. Murad was imprisoned from 2010 to 2020 for planning terrorist attacks, and his brother Ibrahim was jailed in 2014 for undisclosed terror activity. Border clashes between Israel and Lebanese Hezbollah have also resumed since the end of that week-long ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Yemen-based Houthi rebels have continued their activity in the region. On the 26th, Houthi rebels boarded and briefly seized oil and chemical tanker Central Park off the coast of Yemen. That vessel was flying the flag of Liberia and is owned by Zodiac Maritime, a British company which is owned by Israeli billionaire Ilal Ofer. Zodiac says that there are 22 crew members on board from Russia, Vietnam, Bulgaria, India, Georgia, and the Philippines. Additionally, the ship was also carrying a full load of phosphoric acid. This was the second Israeli-owned vessel to be boarded and seized by the Houthis in a week, albeit briefly. The Galaxy Leader was seized on the 20th, as you well know, which we covered in the last episode. U.S. Navy destroyer USS Mason, with allied ships from Maritime Forces Counter-Piracy Combined Task Force 151, received a distress signal from Central Park off the coast of Yemen. When the ships with Task Force 151 arrived, five armed individuals disembarked the ship and attempted to flee in a small boat. USS Mason sent a visit board search and seizure team to chase after the pirates. The team was able to capture all five of the pirates with only warning shots being fired. The Pentagon claims that these pirates were Somalis and not Houthi rebels as initially reported, although there are questions as to whether or not the Somalis have ties with the Houthis considering the area that the ship was hijacked. About an hour and 40 minutes later, two ballistic missiles fired from Houthi-controlled territory in Yemen landed just 10 nautical miles away from the Mason and Central Park. The Pentagon believes that these missiles were targeting Central Park and not the Mason, although either way, that is a pretty big escalation in the region. On the 28th, USS Kearney shot down an Iranian KAS-04 drone that was launched by the Houthis as well. That drone was flying towards the ship. Kearney was escorting USNS Supply and another U.S. flagship that was carrying military equipment to the area. Roughly 140 other people are still being held hostage in Gaza. So far, over 100 hostages have been released. This includes three Americans. Additionally, multiple hostages have been found deceased inside Gaza, and at least one hostage, has been rescued during the first days of that ground operation. The ceasefire deal with Hamas is what saw the majority of these hostages being released. That ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel was initially only going to be 4 days, but it was extended to a week on the condition that Hamas released more hostages and Israel released more Palestinian detainees. A separate deal between Hamas and Egypt also saw a number of non-Israeli hostages being released. Those are mostly Thai and Filipino nationals. Fighting has resumed in Gaza between Israeli and Palestinian militants after that 7-day pause. Talks are ongoing to initiate another ceasefire as Hamas still has hostages to leverage. Qatar and Egypt are leading those discussions, but as of right now, nothing is concrete. We have an update on the November 18th explosion at the UN-run Al-Fukra school in Jabalia, Gaza. The explosion was indeed an Israeli airstrike. Hundreds of Palestinians were taking shelter in the school when the explosion happened. Videos posted from the school do show the bodies of at least 30 people who were either dead or severely injured at the time. This includes women and children. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry claims that 50 people were killed in that strike. That is revised down from their initial claim of 80 deaths. Israel acknowledged launching airstrikes in Jabalia at the time, saying that it killed multiple terrorists, although it did not explicitly acknowledge striking the school at the time. Since October 17th, there have been at least 70 drone and rocket attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria. The Pentagon has confirmed 59 casualties so far. This includes at least 25 traumatic brain injuries. All 59 have since returned to duty, thankfully. The U.S. military has launched 4 retaliatory response strikes. looking at allied naval forces in the region. Thank you to Ian Ellis and Intel Schizo on Twitter for their infographics. Standing NATO Maritime Group 2 has left the area and is in the Western Mediterranean for training. Therefore, I will not include that in further episodes. The Israeli Navy has 3 corvettes and 1 missile boat operating south of Cyprus. The Dwight D. Eisenhower Carrier Strike Group is currently in the Persian Gulf. The Bataan Amphibious Readiness Group is in the Red Sea. 5 ships are south of Cyprus on humanitarian missions. Those are 2 French ships, 2 Italian ships, and 1 Indonesian ship. British Littoral Response Group South is near Cyprus as well. The UN Interim Force in Lebanon has 7 ships in the Eastern Med. U.S. Patrol Forces Southwest Asia and Task Force 52 are currently operating in the Gulf of Oman. Combined Task Force 151, which I talked about earlier, is still off the coast of Yemen. And there are at least 33 other ships in the region, including U.S. ships, that are not assigned to a task force or assigned to a mission tied to the situation in Gaza. And we will take a quick break and we'll be right back with Africa. All right, we're back with Africa, taking a look at Sudan. Don't have any major updates in the conflict, but of course, fighting is still ongoing between the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces. The war has so far forced 6.1 million people from their homes. 1.3 million of those have fled to other countries. Additionally, between 9,000 and 10,000 people have been killed. Looking at Somalia, I missed this last week. On the 24th, Somalia officially became the 8th member nation of the East African Community, the EAC. This was done at the EAC summit in Arusha, Tanzania, after months of negotiations. The EAC is currently an economic bloc. However, the official plans of the community is for all 8 member states to eventually join into one state called the East African Federation. With Somalia as a member, the EAC will have access to the Arabian Sea and the Gulf of Aden as well. Looking at Sierra Leone, on the 26th, an apparent coup attempt was carried out in the capital of Freetown. A group of gunmen attacked the military barracks in the neighborhood of Wilberforce and were repelled. They also attacked 2 prisons and multiple police stations, leading to over 2,200 detainees being freed. An assault was also carried out on the presidential lodge, but that was also repelled. A nationwide curfew has been imposed in Sierra Leone. At least 21 people, including 14 soldiers, were killed in the violence. The government says that it has arrested 13 military officers and 1 civilian connected to the attempt. Information Minister Chernor Bah claims that the coup attempt was led by bodyguards of former President Ernest Bai Koroma. This may give some credence to the theory that the incident was connected with the presidential election in June. Koroma was not on the ballot, but his party, the All People's Congress, did lose that election. Some APC supporters believe that their defeat in the election was not legitimate. Authorities are not sure if Koroma was involved in the coup attempt, but they are investigating that. Moving on to the Americas, Bulletin from the Borderlands released on December 1st. We covered the arrest of a major player in the Sinaloa cartel and the possibility of a new war in South America. Looking at Venezuela, the country is set to hold a referendum on December 3rd, tomorrow, on whether or not to annex the region of Essequibo in Guyana, which actually makes up 2/3 of Guyana. There's a dispute over who owns Essequibo, and that has been going on for hundreds of years, going back to when the area was a Dutch colony, and Venezuela is actually controlled by Spain. During the reign of Hugo Chavez, Venezuela did not make a lot of noise regarding the dispute. Then Nicolas Maduro came to power in 2013, and in 2015, Guyana was found to have the largest oil reserves per capita in the entire world. This gave Maduro a lot of incentive to reassert the claim to Essequibo, especially as American oil companies have been signing contracts with the Guyanese government. Venezuela, of course, has the largest amount of oil reserves, period, out of any country in the whole world. The International Court of Justice on December 1st ordered Venezuela to not hold the December 3rd referendum. This is a temporary order until the court can make a final decision regarding who owns the region at a later time, which likely won't be for a number of years. Since the ICJ falls under the United Nations, there is a serious question as to how the order will be enforced. Venezuela has made it clear that they still plan to hold that vote tomorrow, and they are currently delivering ballot boxes around the country. It isn't clear what Venezuela plans to do after the referendum, which is expected to overwhelmingly favor the annexation of the region. Moving on to the U.S., got a presidential race update. These are poll averages from 538. Biden's approval is at 38. That is down 1 point from last week. His disapproval is at 55. That remains the same. Trump's favorability is at 42. His unfavorability is at 53. Both of those remain the same. The Democrat primary, Biden is at 67. He remains the same. Marianne Williamson is at 7%. She is up 1 point. And Congressman Dean Phillips is at 4%. He remains the same. Looking at the Republican primary, Trump is at 60. He remains the same. DeSantis is at 12. He also remains the same. And Nikki Haley is at 9%. She is down 1 point. Some deaths happened over the week as well. Of course, you had former U.S. Secretary of State, National Security Advisor as well, Henry Kissinger. He passed away at 100 years old on November 29th. And then you had Sandra Day O'Connor, the first female justice to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. She passed away at 93 years old on yesterday, December 1st. The Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum was held in San Francisco from November 11th to the 17th. You may have seen that a major diplomatic breakthrough that was allegedly made, according to U.S. President Joe Biden, was that Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed to resume military communication between the two countries. Considering the heightened tensions between the U.S. and China, as well as the multiple incidents that have taken place between the Chinese and U.S., as well as allied militaries in recent months, military communication is pretty important. China broke off that line of communication after the then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi took a trip to Taiwan in August 2022. Well, it's been 2 weeks since that commitment was allegedly made by Xi, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General C.Q. Brown, says that he is still waiting for a response phone call from the People's Liberation Army. Moving on the 25th, three 20-year-old Palestinian students were shot in Burlington, Vermont, while visiting the city for Thanksgiving break. They grew up together in the West Bank. That's how they all know each other. Two of them are U.S. citizens right now, and the other is a permanent resident. They are Hisham Oratani, Tashin Ali Ahmed, and Kanan Abdelhamid. They were walking around the neighborhood of a family home when the suspect, Jason Eden, ran up to them and began shooting from 6 feet away. Oratani was hit in the spine, Abdelhamid was hit in the backside, and Ahmed was hit in the chest. The three men believe that they were targeted because they were speaking Arabic and English and wearing traditional Palestinian scarves. Eden was arrested and charged with three counts of attempted murder. And last story of the week, on December 1st, U.S. Representative George Santos, the Republican from New York, was expelled by the House of Representatives. House Republicans now have a majority of only three seats. A special election to replace Santos is currently to be dated. We'll keep you guys up to date whenever that gets set. Santos is the sixth member of the House to be expelled in U.S. history, and three of those were expelled for being members of the Confederacy during the Civil War. The vote to expel him was 311 to 114. 206 Democrats and 105 Republicans voted in favor. This expulsion came amid two federal indictments and a House Ethics Committee report detailing some of Santos's behavior. That report delved into some of the same allegations as his indictments. The committee determined that Santos misused funds donated to his campaign and Redstone Strategies, which is an independent political firm linked to him. Redstone donors were told that their donations would go towards funding campaigns. Santos used some of these funds on French luxury brand Hermes, plastic surgery and Botox, credit card bills and other debts, personal trips to Atlantic City and Las Vegas, and OnlyFans. Santos is facing 23 felonies in his two federal indictments, to which he has pleaded not guilty. He has 9 counts of wire fraud, 3 counts of money laundering, 2 counts of theft of public funds, 2 counts of making materially false statements to the House of Representatives, 1 count of conspiracy to commit offenses against the U.S., 1 count of making false statements to the FEC, 2 counts of falsifying a record or document, 2 aggravated identity theft counts, and 1 count of unlawful monetary transactions of over $10,000. That is all I have for you guys this week. I want to thank you all for supporting this podcast. Of course, it means a lot to me. You can find this on your favorite apps. That includes Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen, we're there. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Analyze Educate. That is all one word. We are also on Telegram, same name. Please consider supporting us on Patreon, Ko-Fi, or Substack. You can find all those links in the show notes below. Please be sure to leave us a 5-star rating on the app used to listen to this podcast. That helps us out a lot as well. And I will see you guys soon.